We have the lions, the eagles, the bears, the saints, and the rams. As a matter of fact, we even have the chiefs. There are several chief kings mentioned in these chapters, as well as the chief of all the universe, the Ancient of Days, Jehovah God. Believe it or not, we even have the Oilers. We'll talk about Greece. You've got to laugh now. And there's an unnamed beast here in these chapters, which is described as dreadful and terrible. Sounds a lot like the falcons to me. And to round out the list, we have a horn, which we're told has eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. That's got to be the TV commentator, John Madden. But sorry, Daniel does not describe National Football League teams. Instead, Daniel's prophecies here in chapters 7 and 8 concern a league of nations. Daniel is writing in 553 B.C., and he's given a glimpse of the future. He's shown 2,500 years of Gentile world domination. Daniel sees four beasts rising out of the sea. The four beasts represent four world-governing empires. Empires that stretch from Daniel's time even until our day. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. These kingdoms ruled the world for 1,000 years and will be revived in the last days. Daniel's vision in these two chapters really constitutes one of the most remarkable in all the scriptures. The precision at which Daniel prophesies future events is amazing. The rise and fall of kings and kingdoms was known by Daniel long before they appeared on the pages of history. These two chapters provide irrefutable proof that there is a God who dwells outside of time, a God who sees the end from the beginning, a God who is sovereign over world events. With that in mind, let's kick off chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now, the first year of Belshazzar was 553 B.C. And chronologically, chapters 7 and 8 fits between chapters 4 and 5. Remember, the book of Daniel is divided into two portions. The first six chapters are the narrative of Daniel's life, while the last six chapters are the visions of the future that God gave to Daniel. God gives to Daniel four visions. One in chapter 7, one in chapter 8, one in chapter 9, and one in chapters 10 through 12. The most sweeping and comprehensive of these visions is chapter 7. And yet, chapter 8, 9, and 10 through 12 go back and fill in the gaps and the pieces that this sweeping vision encompasses here in chapter 7. As a matter of fact, the Jewish scribes who copied the Old Testament considered Daniel 7 the greatest chapter in all the Scriptures. He says, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Notice Daniel is only giving us the main facts. There were parts of the vision that he didn't tell us. He's giving us basically an essential summary. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. Now, we'll gather from the context of the chapter that what Daniel sees is actually symbolic. And throughout the Scriptures, the sea is symbolic for lost humanity. In Isaiah chapter 57, verse 20, we're told, but the wicked are like the troubled sea, when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. You know, we still use this kind of imagery. How often do we refer to a sea of humanity? The sea represents lost humanity. The wind represents the providence of God. God is the one who stirs up the nations. He manipulates world events according to His purpose. The first of these beasts was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, "Arise, devour much flesh." After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, who had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. Now there's no need for us to speculate as to the identity of these beasts. If we peek ahead, Daniel tells us what they represent. In verse 17, we're told, "Those great beasts, which are 4 kings which rise out of the earth." It's interesting, but nations are still symbolized by animals. Great Britain's symbol is that of the lion. The United States is the eagle. Russia is the bear. Daniel sees here a progression of world empires. The same progression of nations that Nebuchadnezzar saw in chapter 2. He sees 4 Gentile empires that rise from the time of Daniel all the way through to the time of the end and dominate global politics. Now, the first of these world governing empires was Babylon. Babylon ruled the world from 605 to 539 B.C. It's interesting, Jeremiah referred to Nebuchadnezzar as a lion. In Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 19, Ezekiel saw him as an eagle. Ezekiel 17, verse 3. The famed Ishtar gates, the gates that provided the entrance into ancient Babylon, were adorned with winged lions. The winged lion, illustrated by Daniel, was actually an ancient symbol for the Babylonians. But notice what happens to his wings. They're plucked out. You remember the story how that Nebuchadnezzar became proud. And God humbled him. And he was given the heart of an animal, heart of a beast, so that he would be humbled. Here we're told that he was given a heart of a man. He was brought down to his knees. He was humbled. Rather than exalting himself as a god, he realized his humanity and his dependence upon God. Daniel chapter 4 provides the background to Daniel's prophecy here. Nebuchadnezzar, the predator, the one who once stalked the earth like a beast, was tamed by the hand of God, the ultimate lion tamer. Now, after the Babylonians, we know that the Medo-Persians ruled the earth from 539 to 331 B.C. Notice Daniel here projects them as the bear raised up on one side. Why raised up on one side? Well, at the outset of the empire, the Medes and Persians were pretty much co-equals. But as time went on, the Persians began to ascend to a greater position than the Medes. Thus, the bear was tipped up on one side. Notice the 3 ribs between its teeth. The Medo-Persian Empire conquered 3 kingdoms in building their empire: Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. And notice what they say about this beast. They say, "Arise, devour much flesh." Persians had very little regard for human life. They waged these massive battles where they employed millions of men. We're told by one historian that Xerxes, one of the Persian kings, actually launched an army of 3 million men. The Persians were like a bear. They were slow and they were plodding. They sought to crush their enemies, trample them, even though it might cost them thousands of men of their own. Their goal was to crush and to devour much flesh. After the Persians, the Greeks rose to power. The Greeks ruled the earth from 331 to 146 B.C. Like a leopard with four wings, the Greeks were a combination of splendor, skill, strategy, and speed. Under Alexander the Great, the Greeks conquered the whole civilized world in less than 10 years. Throughout his conquest, Alexander spread the Greek culture, the Greek language, all over the world. By the time of Christ, the whole world spoke Greek. When Alexander died, he left his empire to his four generals, which are depicted here as the leopard's four heads. We'll talk more about Alexander when we get to the section on the Greeks in chapter 8. Now he goes on. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. Now it was this fourth beast that really shook up Daniel. Remember, Daniel was the guy who had spent the night with the beasts in the lion's den and had not been afraid. But now he sees this fourth beast. And it scares him. This is something that he's never seen before. This last beast makes the animals in Jurassic Park look like kitty cats. He says, I saw this beast, dreadful and terrible, or literally menacing and mighty, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. In other words, it had a blacksmith for a dentist. I guess we could call these guys the Steelers. Ooh, yeah. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, you have to kind of take what I said earlier. I said that the beast that was dreadful and terrible was probably the falcons. But the falcons haven't devoured and trampled anyone for a long time. Maybe the cowboys, but probably not the falcons. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, after the Greeks came the Romans. And the Romans ruled the world from 146 B.C. to 476 A.D. The Romans were indeed menacing and mighty. They ruled the world for 600 years, longer than the Babylonians, the Persians, and the Greeks combined. The Roman Empire extended from England to Egypt, from the Atlantic to the Euphrates. Far outstretched the borders of its predecessors. And Rome became famous for its cruelty, for its devouring and trampling nature. Its lust for blood was unrivaled in the ancient world. It was the Romans who invented crucifixion, the gladiators, the human torches, the sport that was made of feeding the Christians to the lions, all expressed the ruthlessness of Rome. Rome indeed devoured and trampled. Now, in a sense, this fourth beast represents Rome, ancient Rome. But in another sense, it represents much more than ancient Rome. Now, we need to understand two characteristics of Bible prophecy. First, prophecy usually involves a dual fulfillment. Often, a single prophecy has both an immediate or short-term fulfillment along with a future or end times fulfillment. Second, there are often hidden gaps of time in the fulfillment of a prophecy. Some prophecies are like looking at a mountain range, a range of peaks. You know that those peaks are separated by miles and miles of distance, of valleys, large valleys. But when you look at that mountain peak from a distance, it looks as if it's one peak, as if everything's right there together. And a lot of Bible prophecies, we look at them and we don't recognize the gaps of time, the hidden gaps of time that exist within them. There might actually be several peaks, you know, with large valleys between them. And in a Bible prophecy, there might actually be several events with long periods of time between them, and yet they appear in the text to us as if they all occur simultaneously. Such is the case here. The fourth beast is a description of the Roman Empire. But as we see, as we're going to see, it is during the reign of this fourth empire that God destroys the kingdoms of man and establishes His own kingdom on the earth. Now, has this happened in history? Of course not. And so thus, this is not speaking of ancient Rome alone, but it must also be speaking of an empire that's yet future, and this is what has prompted many Bible scholars into assuming that in the last days there's going to be a revival of the old Roman Empire. This fourth beast is ancient Rome, but it's more than ancient Rome. It also includes the Rome of the last days, the revival of the Roman Empire that will bring to power this little horn that's seen by Daniel in verse 8, the Antichrist, who will rule over the whole world from the city of Rome. Now, one more point before we move on here. Daniel is essentially seeing what the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar had seen in chapter 2. But the difference, Nebuchadnezzar was observing history from man's viewpoint. And therefore, he saw human government as a metallic, shiny, polished image, a thing of beauty and glory. But Daniel is observing human government from God's viewpoint. And from God's viewpoint, the kingdoms of man are bestial and brutal, barbaric, ravage and savage, animalistic monsters that frighten and destroy. What a contrast of perspectives. Now I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. Now this phrase, the Ancient of Days, literally means days without beginning, or the one who has been around forever. You know who this is. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. This reminds us of the description of Jesus Christ. Revelation chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. He says, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, or an innumerable multitude. The court was seated and the books were opened. God's tribunal has come to order. Now I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Now we know who this Son of Man is. He is none other than Jesus Christ, because Jesus applies this passage from Daniel to himself in Matthew chapter 26, verse 63. There in the midst of Jesus' trial before the high priest, the priest asked Jesus, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus answered him saying, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then we're told that the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. You see, the high priest knew that Daniel had lifted, or that Jesus had lifted, this quotation from Daniel. And had taken a quotation that the Jews recognized as speaking of the Messiah and had applied it to himself. Jesus, in essence, was making himself equivalent to the Ancient of Days. Now, then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. We're told in Psalm 2 that God will give to his Son the nations as an inheritance and the ends of the earth as a possession. When Jesus returns, the kingdoms of man will be replaced by the kingdom of God, and Jesus will rule over this world forever and ever. What a glorious day. It wouldn't bother me if it happened real soon. He says, "Now I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. And so he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts, which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever." Now the word saint always means to be set apart or devoted to God. And in contrast to the Gentile kingdoms that are in discussion here, the Jews are those who are set apart. The Jews are those that are here referred to as saints. God promised to David that Israel would one day be given an everlasting kingdom. The Messiah would reign in Israel. And here Daniel foresees Israel's coronation day. Now this had to have been a great encouragement to Daniel, because you remember at this time Jerusalem has been destroyed. The temple has been burned to the ground. The Jewish people themselves were in exile in Babylon. The Gentiles now controlled the world, including the land of Israel. What would happen to the nation? What would their future include? Had God's promises failed? God is showing Daniel that no, Gentile world domination will one day come to an end, and God will again restore Israel and fulfill His promises to His people. Great encouragement to Daniel. Now then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Now, Daniel wants more information about this fourth beast. It was the fourth beast that really piqued his curiosity. Apparently here, it is the angel who is now going to speak to Daniel and is going to answer his question and to explain what he has just seen. And thus he said, "The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all others and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings. Horn was a symbol of strength. And so it became a symbol for human government or human ruler. These 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom." Now Daniel sees this revived Roman Empire taking the form of 10 horns, or a 10-nation confederacy. The emergence of just such a political entity began on March the 25th, 1957, with the signing of a treaty called the Treaty of Rome. Half a dozen European nations, all descendants of the former Roman Empire, pledged themselves to unite. France, Belgium, West Germany, Luxembourg, Italy, and the Netherlands all signed the treaty, and the European Economic Community was born. In the 35 years since, the EEC has expanded its membership and has slowly intensified its efforts towards unification. We know from Daniel that eventually Europe, the descendants of the former Roman Empire, will eventually emerge into a 10-nation confederacy. It's amazing how that over time, different people have tried to unite Europe and have tried to revive ancient Rome. Bismarck, Hitler, Napoleon, all had their crack at trying to reunite Europe, and they all failed. But what power and military force failed to do, economic unity will accomplish. And I believe it's through the EEC that eventually Europe will take its final shape and form into this 10-nation confederacy. A major breakthrough toward European unification occurred on January the 1st, 1992. When on that day all trade barriers were eliminated and the borders of the EEC nations were opened. Most recently, there has been talk of allowing the Eastern European countries into the EEC. The forces that are driving Europe toward unification are irresistible. Just this last year, the Maastricht Treaty propelled the process of unification even further, with agreements aimed toward full economic and military and political cooperation among member states. The walls of national sovereignty are coming down. As Helmut Kohl, the German chancellor, was recently quoted as saying, "War in Europe is only avoidable through European union. And for that reason, political unity is the most important of all." You see, it is only a matter of time before we see emerging a United States of Europe. As America and Russia continue to decline, Europe and the countries of the Far East are becoming the new power centers on the earth. Today, the EEC has developed into the world's largest trading cartel, accounting for a quarter of the world's trade. All this is happening just as the Bible predicted. It goes on, "And another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings." Now another king will rise out of the 10 kings. He will overcome 3 obstructionist states and rule over the other 7. This king will eventually rule the world. Remember, Daniel tells us that the fourth beast devoured the whole earth. This little horn rises up among the other 10 horns and becomes the ruler of the whole earth. Now, this little horn, as Daniel calls him, is described in Scripture by other names. He is referred to as the seed of the serpent, as the Assyrian, as the man of sin, as the willful king, as the lawless one, as the beast, and the name that you're most familiar with, the Antichrist. You know, the key impediment, even as we speak, toward European unification is the lack of a dominant leader. Martin Garber, a former East German official, commenting on the power vacuum that has been created since the fall of communism, made this statement. He said, "Power is lying on the ground waiting for someone to pick it up, and someone will." Henry Speck, a leading official within the EEC, made this shocking and prophetic statement. He said, "We don't want another committee. We want a man of stature to hold the allegiance of the people and lift us up out of the economic mess we've gotten ourselves into. Send us a man, whether he be God or a devil. Send him." Europe is desperate for a leader. It doesn't matter whether he is a god or a devil, Speck says. They want a leader. They're being set up for the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. I believe it's quite possible, if not probable, that the Antichrist is alive and on the earth today and is somewhere being groomed for his future role. He goes on describing the Antichrist. "He shall speak pompous words against the Most High." Now, the Antichrist goes by many names, but the name that I like to give him is Blabbermouth. Because wherever you see him in the Scriptures, he's always spouting out blasphemies against God. He's always speaking pompous words. He's the Blabbermouth. "He shall persecute the saints of the Most High and shall intend to change times and laws. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time." Now the Antichrist will be so arrogant that he'll even try to alter the calendar. Maybe even as far as down as the days and the weeks. You see, he'll tinker with fundamental principles of law. He'll probably be trying to strip our culture of all vestiges of a Judeo-Christian heritage. He'll be attempting to usher in a new age for a new world order. Notice he speaks pompous words and persecutes the saints of Israel. The word persecute here means to wear out. For a time, a times, and a half a time, which was a Hebrew way of saying 3.5 years. The Antichrist conducts a second Holocaust. In verse 21, we're told that he prevails against the saints. Now, there are those that try to equate the saints here with the church, and therefore teach that the church is going to go through the great tribulation. But the careful Bible student knows better. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, Jesus told his disciples, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." You see, here the Antichrist prevails against the saints. He wears them out, and therefore they cannot be the church. They must be Israel. We know that after a signing of a treaty with Israel that begins the last week of Daniel, the 70th week of Daniel, the final 7 years. At the middle of those 7 years, the Antichrist will violate that treaty. And as a result, he will viciously attack the Jews. A second Holocaust will occur. "But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever." Remember now, while the Antichrist is attacking the Jews on earth, God's court is still in session. God still has jurisdiction. God is going to punish this evil person. In Revelation 19, verse 20, we're told that the Antichrist will be cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. The kingdoms of man will come to a close, and the kingdom of God will be established forever. "Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey Him." This is the end of the account. "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart." In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, And the third year was 551 B.C. And so chapter 8, he sees this vision about 2 years after the vision he saw in chapter 7. A vision appeared to me Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Now, Daniel is in Babylon, physically, but he's transported in this vision eastward toward the city of Shushan or Susa, which was 375 miles east of Babylon. Shushan would be the birthplace of the Medo-Persian Empire and would serve as the capital of the Persian king. It was in Shushan that we find both Nehemiah and Esther. This is the place, the setting for those stories. Daniel, though, is taken in a vision to the origins of Persian power to be shown the coming of this next great empire. Remember, at this time, he's in Babylon. Babylon is in control. But Daniel is now shown future events. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. Now again, there's no need to speculate here. Verse 20 identifies the ram as the Medo-Persian Empire. It's interesting that the Persian king wore a crown, a gold crown, made like a ram's head. At the Persian capital of Persepolis, they found ram's heads engraved on sculptured pillars. The ram apparently was an ancient symbol for the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, the two horns here on the ram represent the two divisions of the kingdom, the Medes and the Persians. And the horn that ends up overshadowing the other is the Persian side. History tells us that during the reigns of Xerxes and Darius, the Persians became dominant over the Medes. Remember, you know, as we read this, we assume that Daniel is writing as a historian, but not so. He's a prophet. He is speaking things yet future. He is recording these subtle details before the fact, not after the fact. It makes it amazing when you realize what's actually being written here. This is prophecy, not history. Daniel is writing at a time when Babylon is still the dominant world empire. All these things are yet future. Now, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. The Persian Empire did expand northward toward Asia Minor or Lydia, westward toward Babylon, and southward into Egypt. The Persians stretched their borders far beyond the borders of Babylon. The Persian Empire became the greatest that the world had ever known, that it had ever seen up until that point. The Persian Empire was the last great Eastern Empire. Now, as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now again, God leaves nothing to guesswork. If you look ahead in verse 21, we're told that the goat is Greece. The goat was a symbol of the Macedonians, or the Greeks. The early capital of the Greeks was a city called Aegea, which means the city of the goat. And you all know from your geography the Aegean Sea. The Aegean Sea means the Sea of Goats. The goat was a symbol of Greece. Now, Daniel also tells us here that the notable horn is the Greeks' first king, or the most famous Greek king of all, Alexander the Great. And the next few verses talk about the career of Alexander the Great. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Now, Alexander was quite a young man. The historians tell us that his tutor was a philosopher by the name of Aristotle. Aristotle was many things, but among which he was a brilliant strategist. Alexander learned much of his military strategy from Aristotle. Now, Alexander inherited the command of his father, Philip, the Macedonian. And so he became the general of the Macedonian army in 331 BC at the age of 19. After crushing several of the Greek city-states and unifying the Greeks under his leadership, in 334 BC, Alexander crossed over into Asia Minor, and there confronted the Persians. We're told by the historians that he was outnumbered 500,000 to 40,000. 12-1. And yet he conquered Darius and the Persians and began to plow eastward and southward. Sidon fell. He won a remarkable battle at Tyre. We studied that battle, remember, in Ezekiel chapter 26. And Jerusalem finally surrendered to Alexander in 333 BC. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that while Alexander was in Jerusalem, he was shown a passage of Scripture from the book of Daniel that pointed to him. And Alexander read this prophecy and assumed that he was the one that God had appointed to defeat the Persians. Egypt surrendered to Alexander in 332 BC. In Egypt, he was crowned the Pharaoh, and he built the lavish city of Alexandria. He then marched northward to the ultimate conflict between he and the Persians. In 331 BC, he took the city of Babylon, which he later intended to make his new capital. He then conquered Persepolis and Ectabania. He continued pushing further and further east. Alexander made it all the way to India, where his weary troops finally put their foot down and said, "Enough was enough. We're tired. We need a break." In a little less than 10 years, Alexander the Great had conquered the entire known world. Just as we're told, as Daniel says in verse 5, he was like a male goat skipping across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. Legend has it that toward the end of his life, he lay down on his bed in tears, crying that there were no more worlds to conquer. It was said of another Greek general, Dionysius, a tub was large enough for Dionysius. A world was too little for Alexander. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Now, Alexander died in 323 BC at the age of 33. At the very pinnacle of his career, the story goes that after several rounds of heavy drinking, he got sick. 12 days after getting sick, he died. Alexander literally drank himself to death. But while lying on his deathbed, several of his friends approached him and asked him to whom would he give the kingdom. He was reported to have whispered, "Give it to the strong." Little did he know what chain of events would he set off, replying, "Give it to the strong." This set off a bloody, brutal struggle to decide who would succeed him. His wife Roxanne and his only son were murdered. Eventually, his empire was divided among his four generals, the four notable ones mentioned by Daniel. Cassander took over Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus, Asia Minor. Seleucus, Syria. And Ptolemy, Egypt. Israel found herself between the two warring Greek empires, the Seleucid dynasty to the north and the Ptolemy dynasty to the south. And out of one of them shall come a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Now, the glorious land was a biblical term for the land of Israel. Now, first, don't confuse this little horn here in chapter 8 with the little horn in chapter 7. The little horn here appears towards the end of the Greek Empire, whereas the little horn in chapter 7 appeared at the end of the Roman Empire. There are similarities. And the ruler here in chapter 8 is certainly a type of the one in chapter 7, but Daniel has two different people in mind. The little horn here grows out of the Seleucid dynasty, the Syrian dynasty of the Greeks, which took over Syria, Asia Minor, and even further east toward Babylon. The king that Daniel pinpoints is the eighth king in the line of Seleucid rulers, a man by the name of Antiochus the Fourth. Antiochus the Fourth had a very famous sister who lived in Egypt, Elizabeth Taylor, Cleopatra. Now, Antiochus gave himself the name Epiphanes. You know what Epiphany means. God manifest. We use it at Christmas time. Epiphanes meant God manifest. What a bombastic title to take for yourself, to call yourself God manifest. Antiochus was an arrogant man. His enemies, the Jews, had a nickname for him. It was kind of a play on words. Antiochus called himself Epiphanes. They called him Epimenes, which meant madman. You know, a raving lunatic. That's what he was. And it grew up to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now in Revelation chapter 12, a woman appears who's clothed with the sun and with the moon, who's clothed with the sun and has the moon under her feet. And she's also wearing a garland of 12 stars. The woman in Revelation 12 is the nation Israel, and the 12 stars represent the 12 tribes of Israel. Stars are always a symbol of the Jews. You see, the Seleucids had numerous battles with the Egyptians. The Seleucids were to the north of Israel, the Egyptians to the south. And every time Antiochus would march his armies toward Egypt, he would pass through Israel, where he would persecute the Jews. He came against the stars. He cast them to the ground. He trampled them. Antiochus became an enemy of the Jews. Every time he was disappointed in Egypt, he would come back and take out his fury and frustration upon the Jews. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of the transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Now, Antiochus was a Greek, and it was his ambition to spread Greek culture and religion around the world. He even tried to Hellenize the Hebrews. Antiochus decreed that all the Jews were to bow down and worship the Greek god Zeus. This, though, the Jews wouldn't do. They had not spent 70 years in exile in Babylon for nothing. They had been cured forever of their penchant for idolatry. They refused to bow to Zeus or any other god other than Jehovah. It was for that reason that Antiochus hated the Jews. He hated them. He hated their God. He hated their temple. He defiled the sanctuary. He stopped the sacrifices. He despised the Scriptures. He cast truth to the ground. He destroyed every copy of the Scriptures he could get his hands on. Antiochus' ultimate blasphemy occurred on December the 15th, 168 B.C., when he issued the order to desecrate the temple in Jerusalem. The Greeks offered a pig on the altar. A terrible thing if you understand the Jewish dietary laws. He desecrated the altar of God. He erected within the Holy of Holies a statue of Zeus. This blasphemous act is what the angel refers to as the transgression of desolation. The transgression or the abomination of desolation. This was the final straw. This was the abomination that will bring ultimate desolation, that will bring down the wrath of God. This is why Jesus, in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, refers to a similar action taken by the Antichrist as the abomination of desolation. Remember the Antichrist in Revelation 13 will enter into the Holy of Holies in Jerusalem. He'll set up an image to himself there. And there he will require all the world to bow down and worship before that image. This will be the beginning of the end for the world. This is the straw that will break the camel's back. God will have had enough. He will see this blasphemy, and it will bring down God's judgment, His fierce wrath upon the earth. It's the abomination that will cause desolation. We'll talk more about it, or we did talk more about it when we got to chapter 9. You can refer to the tapes in chapter 9. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Now, Antiochus's blasphemies infuriated the Jews, and particularly a priest by the name of Mattathias. One day, an emissary from Antiochus came to the old priest, Mattathias, and commanded him to bow before the altar of Zeus. Mattathias didn't like that one bit. He grabbed his sword and he slew Antiochus's messenger. This began what has been called the Maccabean Revolt. Mattathias's son, Judas Maccabeus, who goes by the name Judas the Hammer. I like that name, Judas the Hammer. Led a revolt, a guerrilla warfare against Antiochus and the Syrians that eventually led to the taking back of Jerusalem. And on December the 25th, 165 B.C., the temple that had been defiled by Antiochus was cleansed by Judas Maccabeus and the Maccabean priests. After the cleansing of the temple, the Jews wanted to rededicate it to Jehovah. They wanted to reinstitute the proper biblical temple worship. And so they decided to light the golden menorah. The ceremony to rededicate the temple would take 8 days, and they wanted to keep the menorah lit for those 8 days, but they had only one vial of oil. Enough to last just one day, to burn for just one day. Well, they lit the oil, and amazingly, miraculously, the oil burned not for one day, but for the entire 8 days of the Feast of Dedication. And so today, the Jews celebrate what they call Hanukkah, or the Feast of Dedication, the Festival of Lights. It commemorates the miraculous burning of the oil for those 8 days while the temple was rededicated to God. This is a feast, interestingly enough, that according to John chapter 10, verse 22, Jesus Himself celebrated when He went to Jerusalem. There it's called the Feast of Dedication. So even Jesus recognized this holy day. Now what about the 2300 days in verse 14? Well, if you go back 2300 days from the rededication of the temple in 1225, or December the 25th, 165 B.C., you come to September the 6th, 171 B.C., the year that the relationship between Syria and Israel began to deteriorate. What actually happened on September the 6th of that year, we don't know. Now, it's also possible to take this number as 1150 days rather than 2300 days. And the reason for that is that the Hebrew word day is actually an expression for evening and morning. And so the idea being that it could mean 2,300 evenings and mornings, which would equate to 1,150 days. That doesn't help us much either. Because when you track back 1,150 days from December the 25th, 165 B.C., we're not sure what happened then either. And so what all this means about the 2,300 days, your guess is as good as mine. Now it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. The angel Gabriel here appears to Daniel. Gabriel means mighty one of God. And so he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. And as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright, and he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For at the appointed time, the end shall be. Now, Daniel is totally exhausted. All that he's seen has taken his energy out of him. And so he falls asleep. And Gabriel appears to wake him up. Now, he falls asleep even as Gabriel speaks to him. And so this is kind of reassuring to me. I'm not the only one that people fall asleep on when they're trying to speak. And so, if it happened to Gabriel, I guess I'm in pretty good company. Now, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. We know all this already. It's because we read ahead. And as for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise. Now, in the context of Daniel's earlier vision, you'd expect these next few verses to be descriptive of Antiochus. And they do describe Antiochus in a sense. But there are some reasons to view that these verses now bring into focus not just Antiochus, but the one of whom Antiochus is a type, the Antichrist, the ultimate blasphemer. Now, the reasons. First, the tone changes. The subject of the verse is much more sinister than Antiochus ever was. The person that we're about to read about, even as evil as Antiochus was, makes Antiochus look like a Boy Scout. Secondly, Gabriel mentions several times that what he's about to tell Daniel refers to the end of time or to the latter days. Now, the days of Antiochus Epiphanes ended nothing. And so, what does he mean by end of time, the latter days? Third, the point of the vision in chapter 7 and 8 are the end of the Gentile world-dominating kingdoms. And so it would seem fitting that the end of time would then refer to the end or the latter days of world-Gentile domination, which would mean that these verses refer to the leader who will arise out of the revived Roman Empire. The one who will be living at the time when Messiah returns and establishes the kingdom of God. I believe that these verses refer to Mr. Big Mouth himself, the Antichrist. And notice what he says about him. He has fierce features. In other words, he's very imposing. He's a dominating individual. No tenderness, sir. Mercy in him. He understands sinister schemes. The implication here is that he will be well versed in the occult. He will understand satanic ploys and strategy. They say that Hitler kept a library of satanic, occultic material by his bedside and read it every night. Hitler was steeped in the occult, and so will the Antichrist. He will be a New Age practitioner, a New Age leader for a new world order. We're told his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. Now, Revelation 13 tells us that the Antichrist will have a henchman. False prophet will be given power to work miracles. He'll even call fire down from heaven. Satan will empower the Antichrist, and because of his miracles, the world will follow him. He'll be hailed as the ultimate New Age guru. You see, he will have power, but it will not be his own power. It'll be the power of Satan animating him, giving him the ability to do these wonders and signs. You know, this sort of fits right in to the conditions we find around us. You know, the world today is hungry for the supernatural. Think about the 30,000 people who flock every month to Conyers, of all places, to try to get a glimpse of the supernatural. It's sad. People today seek a miracle. The problem is that most people are more interested in the miracle than they are in the truth. Now you see, when Jesus performed miracles, he always performed miracles to substantiate or to testify of the truth that he had taught them. And so when miracles substantiate the truth, they're good. But when miracles are substituted for the truth, they are bad. And when the Antichrist comes, people, because of this hunger for the supernatural, will sell out the truth to experience these miracles and to follow these miracles that the Antichrist will be working. We can see how we're being set up. Our world today is being set up for this coming world ruler. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Prosper and thrive. In other words, he'll possess the Midas touch. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand. He'll be the ultimate Machiavellian strategist. You know, he will use the lies to get his way. The ends will justify the means. He'll have an astute political savvy. He'll say what the people want to hear to get his programs passed. He'll be cunning. He'll pose solutions to problems that no one else has ever dreamed of. And he shall magnify himself in his heart. He'll make himself out to be God, we're told in Revelation 13, and he'll demand all the world to bow down and worship him. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Revelation 19 tells us that he will rally all the armies of the world to the valley of Jezreel, to that enormous, massive plain, which we stood there on the side of Mount Carmel and we looked out over the Valley of Megiddo, or Armageddon. Napoleon once stood there and he proclaimed, truly, all the nations of the world, all the armies of the world could come and camp in this valley. It's enormous. There we're told that all the armies of the world will gather. The Antichrist will rally them together to fight against the Prince of Princes, Jesus Christ. To fight against heaven. To hold back the kingdom of God, usurping and taking over from the kingdoms of man. There in the Valley of Megiddo, the staging area will take place where the final battle will be fought between the seed of the woman, Jesus Christ, and the seed of the serpent, the Antichrist. It won't be much of a battle. We're told that he shall be broken without human hand. His defeat will occur in an instant. Without human hand, as a result of divine intervention, the Antichrist will be toppled. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8 tells us the destiny of Christ's archenemy. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Talk about bad breath. Or maybe in this case, good breath. Jesus comes and with the breath of his mouth, he's going to melt the sucker. With the brightness of his glory, it's going to burn him to a crisp. We're told that the Antichrist will be thrown into the lake of fire. It won't be much of a battle. We'll be riding with him, by the way. You know, Jude says that when the Lord comes, he comes with 10,000s of his saints. We'll be with him, with our swords drawn, thinking that we're ready to fight. He'll take care of it all for us. I guess we'll be given mop-up duty. You know, won't we be proud of him then? How proud we'll be of Jesus Christ. Why aren't we proud of him now? We won't be ashamed to stand up for him then. Why are we sometimes timid and reluctant to stand up for him now? That's why God shows us the end from the beginning. That's why he gives us the privilege of reading the final chapter. He wants to take out any mystery. He doesn't want us worrying. He wants us to know who's going to win in the end. And that we're on the winning side. Let's be proud of Him. Let's stand up for Him. He is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. No one was able to help him figure out what he had seen. Boggled his mind, the visions that God had seen, God had given him. And thus we come to the end of chapter 8.